always fascinated by the argument by some people that if a jury of 12 found a person guilty, well, they know better than those on the outside of the courtroom because they got to see all the evidence. Now, if things worked like that, well, there would never be any wrongful convictions. And at this point, if you've been following our podcast long enough, it should be clear that the jury gets a very carefully curated story by both the prosecution and the defense. A story that's often not the entire story for a lot of different reasons. Poor lawyering, there's stuff either side has that isn't admitted into evidence in front of the jury, or even more problematic, there's evidence that never gets collected due to a poor police investigation. Now, poor police investigations can happen for lots of reasons, like lack of resources, or bad training, or outdated and unscientific investigative methods. But sometimes, they happen deliberately, because there's a story the police have created out of bits of unreliable information, gut feelings, or sometimes out of whole cloth, and now they have the task of gathering enough evidence to make that story stick. They have to investigate just enough, but not too much, gather just the right information, but nothing that could hurt their case. Just like they did in the Domingo Martinez murder. Let's start with the state witnesses, the Stallworths, cousin Nathaniel and brothers John and William. Last week, we already discussed Nathaniel recanting almost immediately after his confession. Remember the letter he wrote in 1994 to Mustafa's lawyer apologizing? He said he lied about everything. He said the cops told him that Mustafa and Sean had committed the murder, and that if he didn't go along with it, he'd get charged with the murder too. Now, let's pause for a second here and think about this. At the time the police brought Nathaniel in, as far as we know, well, he was apparently the very first witness they spoke to. They hadn't gotten to his cousins John and William yet. But if he's telling the truth, they weren't really investigating the crime to try and figure out who was involved at that point. They had already decided Sean and his brother were guilty. They were just rounding up the kinds of witnesses, vulnerable ones, to help make their case. Before speaking to Nathaniel, they had no evidence at all that Sean and Mustafa were involved in the murder. No weapon, no forensics, nothing. And yet they demanded confessions from the Stallworths fingering the Thomas brothers in order to create evidence where there was none. Okay, so Nathaniel retracts his confession nearly immediately. Then there's William Stallworth, who tells the Innocence Project all these years later that the police showed him his brother John's statements and told him to basically repeat everything in there. They also told him that John was not going to get any kind of plea deal and they'd pursue the death penalty against him if he didn't also give a similar confession. So he did. Remember, William had originally told them that he knew nothing about the crime and had no involvement. Nathaniel recanted, but they still had John's statement in which he named his brother William. So then, that takes us to John and why he confessed. To be clear, there has never been an official recantation by John Stallworth, but you may remember from last week's episode that there was a rumor that got back to Sean that John, while incarcerated, told other inmates his statements and testimony were lies. Hard to substantiate when there's never been a recantation in writing, but there is this. At some point during Sean's incarceration, he got a letter from John apologizing, saying that he didn't know that Sean and Mustafa would end up with life sentences. Now, he never said that he lied in that letter, but he was remorseful and felt guilty for what happened to the Thomases. Did he lie, though? Was his confession false, too, like Nathaniel and William? Well, when attorney Jim Fogorski spoke to John's mother, she told him that he had been tortured by the police into giving a confession. And when Jim spoke to John directly, he told him the same thing. This was in 2011, after John was already released, but he didn't want to go on the record with it, probably for fear his existing plea deal would be revoked. So here we have a case in which the only evidence that existed pointing to Sean and his brother were three confessions, all false. Like Jim said, how is it possible that none of these men had anything to do with the crime? Well, it is possible. It's possible when the police get to decide what really happened and then create their own evidence. And they didn't just do that with those they were seeking to charge. They also attempted to change stories of the witnesses who saw the murder take place.
We get it. Life insurance is confusing. It can take forever, and if there's ever a payout, you won't even be around to spend it. But one company is making it a lot easier. PolicyGenius.com is the place to go to learn about life insurance, compare quotes from America's top providers, and save up to 40% in your policy. It sounds crazy, but that's never existed before. PolicyGenius has placed over $5 billion in life insurance. Their simple, user-friendly website helps you to work out exactly which policy is right for you and find you the best price. It takes just 5 minutes to apply for a quote. In fact, most Americans think life insurance costs 2 to 3 times more than it really does. If you're one of them, you stand to save more than you think. If you have any questions, they have a team of licensed experts waiting to talk you through it. There's no call waiting, no pressing 3 followed by the pound sign. You get actual customer service. And they don't just do life insurance. You can get health insurance. You can insure your pet. You can protect your income. And if you don't need to do any of that, they'll tell you. If you've been putting off life insurance or want to make sure the insurance you have is right for you, check out PolicyGenius.com today. You can save up to 40% just by comparing policies. The quotes are free. There's no sales pressure and zero hassle. That's PolicyGenius.com. It's life insurance for the 21st century.
Let's start with Ron Smith, the man closest to the crime. When he spoke to the police, who contacted him a couple of weeks after the incident, he told them exactly what he'd seen. The statement is handwritten, and at first glance, you'd think that Smith himself wrote it because his signature is at the bottom. Now, many of the statements of witnesses, police officers, family members, and others are typewritten or handwritten in a different kind of writing. But the handwriting in Ron Smith's statement is identical to statements given by bank guard Gregory Davis and Martinez's daughter, Sarah, and her boyfriend, Benjamin. All of these statements are taken by the same detective, Martin Devlin, who was one of the two lead detectives on the case. In 2011, when Jim reached out to Ron Smith, he seemed to remember a lot more about that day than he did from his 1990 statement. When Jim read the statement out over the phone to Ron, he was surprised and said, well, it seemed rather short, and that all these years later, he actually remembered more now than what was in there. Specifically, in the 1990 statement, the story begins with Smith coming across a Martinez car already pulled over to one side and seeing a man pull the victim out of his car. But in 2011, he tells Jim that he remembers two cars specifically and was directly behind the perp's car, and he saw him hit Martinez. Then he saw them both pull to the side. Now, this is kind of a significant difference because it means he saw the perp's car. He was literally behind it. But his early statement conveniently makes no mention of it. Probably because he never wrote that statement. Martin Devlin did. Did Detective Devlin omit details on purpose? If he did, would we ever know? It makes you realize how much we depend on police statements as if they're the God's honest and whole truth, when in reality, the person taking the statement can probably get away with making it sound just like they want. Then there were the two other men driving together to get some car parts, Alan King and Roy Howard. Now, King's statement was taken the same day by an Officer Miller. It's very clear in identifying the perp's car as having a red top and a white body. But his friend, Roy Howard, told the police in a statement that the car had a white top and a red body. So it's a little unclear which color was on top and which was on bottom, but it does seem sound that the perp's car was red and white, period. Now, Howard was called to testify by the state at trial, and he mentioned the red and white car. He didn't identify either of the brothers as the men that he saw at the scene, and if anything, he was more helpful to the defense, given his repeated insistence that the perp's car was not blue or gray. I wish I could speak to Howard now to ask him what he remembered, but unfortunately, he passed away. I was, however, able to track down Alan King, who now works as security guard in a library in Philadelphia. He wasn't called to testify by either side, which is kind of odd because he could have made a pretty strong defense witness. Today, he doesn't recall that much from the incident, not even that the car was red and white because, well, after all, it's been 27 years since the murder. And I was getting a bit disappointed that I couldn't get more information out of him, but then just as I was getting ready to wrap up our conversation and walk away, he remembered something a little bit shocking.
All right, I don't think we have any other questions. All right, well, thank you so much. I appreciate your time. One of the defendants in this case, I don't know if it was the defendant you testified for, Sean Thomas, was recently exonerated.
Okay.
Yeah, and his conviction was thrown out.
Oh, okay.
So it was proven that he was somewhere else at the time. Right. So 24 years, but he's out now.
Yeah. The whole testimony, like they tried to swear us away from the testimony that we gave about the color of the person.
Yeah.
You know, and he kept asking us, well, to me, it was black. Then he kept saying, you sure it was black. Then he kept saying something about being Spanish or something.
The victim was Spanish.
Yeah. But no, they were talking about the people that actually did the shooting. They did. And I kept telling him, no, they was black.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I don't know whether they picked the wrong people up or what they did, but we didn't hear no more about it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, they ended up arresting 6 people on the case.
Oh, okay.
2 confessed. One of them took back the confessions that he just made it up. The police told him to say it. It was in a bad
situation.
Well,
that sounds about right because the description that we gave, the way they done it, and I read it over, I said, this is not what I told you.
Okay.
They had typed up something totally different from what I had told them.
The statement?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. So I made them go redo it. I said, that's not what I said.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
So they had to retype the statement.
Right. Because the statement I gave, the statement they came back with for us to sign, I said, that's not what I put in there.
And same thing for Roy?
I don't know if it's the same thing for Roy, but no, the one that I read was not the statement that I gave.
Now, ignoring all the details that I got wrong about the arrest, because this was early on in my case research, let's sit still for a minute with what King just said, that on the very day of the murder, the police were already manipulating witness statements. They didn't want the information he gave them because it contradicted the information they put out over the flash report, that they were on the lookout for a gray Nova. Why? Well, for the life of me, I don't know why. It seems like it would be so much easier to track down a red and white car with temporary paper tags, no less, than a nondescript gray car. Why didn't they follow their strongest leads, the witnesses at the scene of the crime itself, and instead rely on Carmen Garcia, the young woman down the street, on her aunt's stoop, who said she saw a gray Nova drive away? I simply don't know. But what I do know is this. Right after the murder occurred, Ron Smith, the witness again who was closest to the crime, drove up to a cop a couple blocks away to tell her what he saw. That cop was Sergeant Frances Rawlings, and here's what she said in the statement she gave the very same day. On this date, at approximately 9:50 a.m., I was traveling westbound on Erie Avenue from Whitaker Street. I was stopped in front of St. Christopher's Hospital on Erie Avenue between Whitaker and Front Street. I was stopped by a white male who was approximately 22 years old. He stopped right in the middle of the block. He pointed back, westbound on Erie, and told me that a black male just pushed a white male out of a car. I rode back to see as far as Front Street, and I didn't see anything. Later, I heard a call of a car being wanted in reference to a homicide. She's then asked about the car that the white male who stopped her was driving. Describe the automobile. Answer. The auto is light blue, faded, 1977 to 78 Nova. I think 2-door. I didn't see the tags. So was the car seen by Carmen Garcia, the one whose description went over the flash report to all the police officers, actually Ron Smith's car? A witness's car and not the perp's car? That pretty much is what it seems like. And from there, it all went and stayed downhill as detectives tried their best to stick to that original narrative. Now, as I said before, there were 2 lead detectives in this case, Martin Devlin and Paul Worrell. I mentioned earlier that Devlin hand-wrote the statements of a number of witnesses, which for me calls into question the integrity of those statements. But then there's this. Both Devlin and Worrell's names appear as investigators at the top of all of the Stallworth confessions, and all of those confessions are also written by hand, in the same handwriting. This time, not Devlin's, but Worrell's. If Devlin and Worrell hadn't been so committed to getting the wrong guys, they probably would have gotten the right ones. It wasn't like they didn't have any stronger lead than the rumor offered by the informant. In fact, they had much stronger leads that they totally dropped. There's a document in the original discovery file that seems important, like really, really important. It's the transcript of a 911 call made on December 5th, 1990, about 3 weeks after Martinez was murdered. The caller, who only identified himself as Donald Sr., called to report that the three men who had killed a Puerto Rican millionaire were hiding out at 1405 Lenox Street in Philadelphia. Donald Sr. said that he knew the owner of the house, Charles Miles, who actually came to tell him this. But Miles was too scared to call the police on his own. He had some mental health issues, and he seemed like he was a bit too vulnerable to either ask the men to leave or to make the police report himself. But he was scared of them, so he had come to stay with Donald Sr. for the previous 5 days. Now, Donald refers to the murder as having happened in the previous week, and in fact, one Hispanic male had been killed in that time period. Problem is that he was killed in a domestic dispute. And the week before that, a 12-year-old Hispanic male was shot during an argument. Going back all the way to Martinez's murder on November 13th of that year, only two other Hispanic males were killed, both in drug-related crimes, one from blunt force trauma and the other from a stab wound. None of the Hispanic males killed between the Martinez murder and the 911 call could really qualify as the murder of a millionaire. Really, I think only Martinez might have. Now, the dispatch officer that took the call asked Donald why he thought these men had something to do with the murder, and his response is kind of vague. He says they come in late at night and it seems like they've been hiding. Basically, it sounds like suspicious activity, but he clearly seems nervous from the transcript. He doesn't want to give his full name and doesn't want the cops coming to his house. And there are important parts of the transcript that just say unreadable, like when he's explaining why the owner of the house has been staying with him out of fear for a few days, and also when he's describing the behavior of the suspicious men. The transcript says, quote, "I noticed that," unreadable. So, not sure what he was noticing, but it's enough that he wants to talk to a police officer. The dispatcher says yes, an officer will be in touch with him and talk to the homeowner, Charles Miles, as well. There is no further evidence, though, in the file that anyone ever followed up with this report. It's just kind of sitting there all by itself. But on the very bottom of the transcript, there is an officer CC'd, Detective Martin Devlin. Now, it could be that Devlin went to go meet with this man or called him and nothing panned out. I can't imagine that no officer at all responded to this call. After all, Donald Sr. provided an address and a phone number. At a minimum, even though there isn't enough in the call to link anyone to any murder, it certainly couldn't have hurt to check it out. Especially because, not long after the murder, three men were pulled over on suspicion of being connected to the crime. But that information never came to light until this past summer. Here's Jim explaining what happened.
The evidence that's, you know, very powerful that was discovered by the DA's office in May. What they found basically, once I took the statements that they had and looked back at what we already had and didn't understand because it didn't make sense out of context, was that police in the 25th District, which is where the murder occurred, stopped a gray Chevrolet Nova, a primer gray Chevrolet Nova, which is what they were looking for, within 3 days of the murder of the victim. And the car was occupied by three African-American males, the same as the murder description. The police found a gun in the car, and the car was submitted to the laboratory that found gray paint on the side of that car, and the victim's car was gray. That was never disclosed to the defense at trial or any other time. They also did interviews with the people who were in that car, and The people who were in that car knew the victim, Domingo Martinez. They were from the neighborhood where he was murdered. And one of the people told the police on the day that he was interviewed in homicide that he had been in a bar, and there was a guy there who was bragging that he had a lot of money and he had robbed a Puerto Rican man, and he had staged an accident with him just a few days before. The man also told the police that this guy makes his living from following people from banks and robbing them. And this man was was in the car that they thought had been used in a murder. And he told the police that the man who was in the bar had access to that car, that he drove it sometimes because he was a cousin of one of the occupants.
He had access to the gray car.
Correct. And also, the man who made that statement to the police, 3 days after the murder, is in jail now for murder himself, for murdering someone else in that neighborhood a few months later with three men. So I think that they recognized how strong that exculpatory evidence was, and that's why it was never turned over.
Did they do any ballistics on that gun?
As far as I know, they never did.
But they tested the car, but they didn't test the gun.
They submitted the paint samples. I don't know if they were ever tested.
Okay.
I never saw any results for that.
So yeah, this is all pretty crazy. A gray Nova gets pulled over 3 days after the murder, with a gun inside, with one of the occupants telling the police officer another occupant had bragged about killing a Puerto Rican. The car turns out to have paint on it, but neither that paint or the gun is ever tested to match the crime. Or was it tested? And poof, the results disappeared. I have no idea. Why the police didn't stay on that trail may have something to do with this, though.
There was a recantation. So the man who made the original statement saying it was this guy in the bar who was bragging, who had access to the car, for some reason, he hand-wrote a note while he was in custody. Remember, he was stopped 3 days after the murder. He's at the homicide unit. He writes some kind of a note to the police apologizing and said that he lied. And the reason he lied was because he was afraid they were going to charge him because they told him he was driving the murder car. And he said none of it was true. So they release him. And several months later, they bring him back in only now. Right. Oh, yeah. In May of 1991 or so, which is about 6 months later, he's brought back in. And this time he's in custody for the murder that he committed in the neighborhood. And then he tells them a different story. And he said, well, it was these guys from 7th and Butler. And I was told that they were splitting up the money that night. And it was this guy, Sean, not Sean Thomas, but another Sean from 7th and Butler and his brother. And they had gone and robbed this guy. And everybody in the bar, Ethan Benanga was talking about it. And they never pursued that as far as I know. I don't know, but it seems to me that they knew something about this murder.
Now, while this witness doesn't seem to be the most reliable, he certainly seems to have something more to offer than that rumor by the informant. And the information he was giving wasn't fed to him, unlike the stalwarts. It would have only been fed to him if the cops wanted to nail him and the other guys with him for the murder. But not following up, not testing anything they found in the car, it all seems to signal that they just weren't interested in these potential perps. And I can't help but wonder if these were the same guys that Donald Sr. said were hiding out in the neighborhood. Other than the obvious reasons they seem highly suspicious, is one more. That they knew Domingo Martinez. And there's a reason that that's important. It's because there's evidence that his murder was not at all random. Whoever murdered Martinez knew him and his routine intimately. The same afternoon that Martinez was killed, a man named Santiago Rosario contacted the police. He had known Martinez for 39 years, and he lived on the same block as one of the properties that Martinez owned. The night before, on November 12th, he noticed Martinez's car parked on the street outside his home around 10 p.m. Now, Rosario had to go somewhere, so he left and he drove off with his own car between 10:30 and 10:45 p.m. When he got back home a couple of hours later, right after midnight, he noticed that Martinez had moved his car into his spot. which I'm guessing probably irritated him. Nonetheless, he probably just went to bed, and in the morning, between 10 and 10:30 a.m., he saw the Martinez car in the exact same spot as the night before, except this time the window was shattered. Which means this, that Martinez left his home that morning, went to open up his business, visited the bank, was killed a little before 10 a.m., the killers took off with his car, and within half an hour, that car was back in the exact same spot it had been in the night before and the morning of. Now, that could not be random. If anything the stalwarts offered was even close to the truth, this was an impossibility. Because, remember, they confessed to scoping out the bank and randomly settling on their victim. What are the odds that they would drive the victim's car back to the exact same spot it was parked in the night before? A victim whose name, much less address, they didn't even know. The odds are slim to none in a city that big. Whoever killed Martinez knew that his car had been in that spot either the night before or the morning of. Within a few days of the murder, someone told the police they were concerned about the potential involvement of the family in Martinez's murder. Specifically, that maybe his daughter, Sarah Negron, and her boyfriend, Benjamin Quiles, had something to do with it. Sarah, 49 years of age at the time of the murder, was interviewed on the afternoon her father was killed. It's a pretty straightforward interview. She was asked to explain what happened that morning, and she described her father coming to open up the shop, calling the bank to arrange for the money, and him heading out as usual. When she was asked if her father had any trouble with anybody or had ever mentioned being followed, she said no, and that was pretty much it. But then, a week later, Detective Devlin went to interview Sarah again, because by this time, rumors about her troubles with her own father had come to light. Devlin didn't beat around the bush, and he asked her directly about why she had been fighting with her father. And here's why. Sarah was married to a man named Manuel Negron for the past 31 years. And yes, at the same time she was married to him, she had a 29-year-old boyfriend named Benjamin Quiles. Devlin quizzed her about the marriage, and she explained that early on, Manuel had been abusive to her and she had thought about getting a divorce, but they just ended up staying together. They had children together, and recently their youngest daughter had just gotten married, but they hadn't slept together in over a year, and they barely even talked at this point. Devlin told her that several sources had informed him that she had a lover on the side, and she admitted to it. She told him that Benjamin lived with his mother and was involved in some petty criminal stuff like selling numbers, which is basically a low-level gambling racket. She described him as light-skinned, about 5'8", with an occasional mustache. Devlin asked if anyone worked with Benjamin, and she said yes. A large, heavy, dark-skinned black man named Richard. She also admitted that her boyfriend knew that her father picked up large sums of money from Mellon Bank, but she told the detective that she had not told Benjamin that her father was picking anything up on that morning. Finally, they ended with this.
Then they asked, is it true that you and your father had a fight recently? And she said yes. She said that her father told her that if she left her husband for her boyfriend, he would throw her out on the street and disinherit her. And she said that she also told her boyfriend that.
Well, while the threat may have kept her from divorcing Manuel, it didn't stop her from seeing Benjamin. Their affair continued. And the next day, Devlin went to meet him. Benjamin first told the detective he was a close friend of Sarah's before admitting they had been having an affair for over a year. According to him, on the morning Martinez was murdered, he went for a bike ride, a long bike ride to a place called Feasterville, Pennsylvania, which would have taken him a little over an hour each way. He said he dropped off his kids at school at 8:45 a.m., came back home to change his clothes, and headed out on his ride. He got to Feasterville around 10 a.m., where he visited a bike shop, and then he got back home around 1:30 p.m., which means he spent about 2 hours in Feasterville. When he got back home, he got a call from a friend of Sarah's telling him that her father had been murdered. Now, there's absolutely no evidence to suggest that a single thing Benjamin ever said was ever investigated. If I was the detective on the case, I would have dug into the story, drilling him down some more and also asking around, hey, did Benjamin go biking regularly? What kind of bike did he have? What was the name of the bike shop he visited? Did anyone see him there? What did he do for the 2 hours he was in Feasterville? Did he have a car? Was it a gray Nova? Was it red and white? Did he own a gun? Unfortunately, it seems this brief interview satisfied Devlin. The trail into investigating whether Sarah and Benjamin had anything to do with the murder stops here. But if Devlin knew then, what we know now, it might not have. Domingo Martinez owned and operated Esther's Travel Agency Incorporated, which had several branches. He was a president of the company, while Sarah both worked for him and was the official secretary. Don't let the name fool you, though. Esther's wasn't just a travel agency. In fact, it was barely a travel agency. Like many small locally owned immigrant businesses in underserved communities, they dabbled in a lot of different things. Check cashing, lotteries, bill payment, and so forth. One of their main services, however, was to operate a community bank. And across the U.S., it's not uncommon to find these unregulated financial institutions where immigrants are heavily concentrated. For many who aren't able to bank at mainstream places for a variety of reasons, they're the only alternative. Undocumented immigrants who wouldn't have the kind of paperwork required to open a bank account at a federally regulated institution can go to one of these underground operations to open an account, save money, send money overseas. Those with poor credit can get loans from these places, and because of the physical and cultural proximity, they just end up being easier to navigate and use than a regular bank. And they serve a huge need. As of just 2 years ago, reports show that 45 million people in this country have no credit history, and that Latinos are much more likely than any other ethnic group to be, quote, credit invisible. So try getting a car, house, or even renting an apartment like that. You can't. And it's big, big business, by the way. These shadow banks do tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars of unregulated transactions a year. This all comes with plenty of strings, of course, because interest on loans is sky high, sometimes even charged weekly. The deposits made by customers aren't insured. And one more level to the dark side is this. It's a place where scammers can cash the Social Security checks of dead people, and where gangs and criminals can launder their money. It's a place where anyone can conduct financial transactions without any questions asked. At least, no questions asked if everybody knows each other, because it's a system built on trust and references. And when Martinez was killed, dozens of families who entrusted him to handle their money for years mourned. At least 60 families had savings accounts with Martinez, and they continued to bank there when the business passed on to his three daughters after his death. Sarah replaced her father and became president of the bank. He never did write her out of his will. But in 1995, 5 years after their father was murdered, all three daughters filed for bankruptcy and disappeared. And so did all the money.
Well, later on, you know, at the time they didn't know about it, but later on, the daughter was it was arrested in Puerto Rico and brought back to Philadelphia to stand charges for several counts of embezzlement and theft, where apparently she had stolen deposits from the bank customers. Great deal of deposits and left them with nothing, and you walked away and left the bank bare. And
so she had stolen the money and gone to Puerto Rico.
Yep. And she was charged with stealing about $90,000, but they really never found out how much she stole because a lot of that money was undocumented.
On April 17th, 1995, a two-page report in the Philadelphia Daily News detailed how Sarah and her sisters defrauded and stole from dozens of families who ended up losing their life savings. The newspaper also reported that after Martinez was murdered, Sarah split up with her husband Manuel, who fell on his own hard times, losing nearly $100,000 of other people's money in gambling, and then he likewise disappeared. One man quoted in the piece said he will never be able to buy his two daughters a home. He had deposited $26,000 with Manuel, money he had made over many painstaking years working for a lighting company. One of Sarah Negron's customers first realized something was wrong when she visited the location and found it locked. She tried calling, but the number was disconnected. She had deposited over $3,000 with Esther's, saving up slowly for her own funeral so her children wouldn't have to bear the cost when she passed away. Three brothers, Ambrosio, Luis, and Santo Davila, lost the $27,000 they had in a joint account with Esther's travel agency. Two of the brothers were migrant farm workers, and the third was a machinist. It was their life savings. The news report read, "Yes," said Ambrosio, his hand twisted from decades of picking beans and berries. "The lady did the cuckoo fly. The money's gone." There was no recourse for any of these people. They had put their money and trust with the Negrons in exchange for a handshake and a deposit book. Sarah had actually fled to Puerto Rico, and in 1997, she was extradited back to Pennsylvania, where she faced numerous charges including theft, misapplication of monies, and criminal conspiracy. She pled guilty to all charges and served a long period of probation, but never paid back any of the money she and her sisters had stolen. And in 2013, she died at the age of 72, with her last reported address still in Philadelphia. So whatever happened to her boyfriend, Benjamin? Well, he didn't flee to Puerto Rico with her after she had embezzled her customers' funds. But right before she left the U.S. mainland, she made sure that he was taken care of. She transferred the property that Esther's travel agency was built on to Benjamin for a dollar. And as far as we can tell, he still lives in Pennsylvania. So who killed Domingo Martinez if the Stallworth and Thomas brothers had nothing to do with the crime? Was it the three men stopped a few days after the murder in Gray Nova? Was it Sarah and her boyfriend? Maybe it was a combination. Maybe Sarah hired some men to do the terrible deed. Now, it's possible that the Martinez family had nothing to do with the killing. But here is what nags at me. He didn't actually have to be killed if all they were after was the money. And let's start with that premise, that they were after the money. And they knew it was in the trunk of his car because they dragged him out and they took off with the car. They didn't want the car, though, because they abandoned it immediately. Now, there are only a few possibilities as to how they knew the money was in the trunk. First, the perps had been scoping him out for a while, maybe days or weeks. They knew where he lived, where he parked, where he banks, and where he stashes the money after leaving the bank. The second possibility is that they only had begun following him that morning and they saw him put the money in the trunk. The third possibility is this, that no one followed him from the bank, but they already knew he had the money in the trunk because someone told them that he would. Sticking with the premise that they were after the money and they knew it was in the trunk, well, if they wanted to rob an old man driving alone, it would have been more than enough to sideswipe him, make him open up the trunk, grab the money and go. Maybe punch him, incapacitate him somehow. They could have worn masks if they were worried about being identified. But were they really worried about that, though? There were so many other witnesses around, in broad daylight. The tall man in the red jacket or sweatsuit or whatever it was, the guy with the gun, the first thing he did was shoot Martinez, point blank, right in the chest. Then he took the car and the money. To me, this is not just a robbery. This is also not a robbery gone wrong. I am pretty sure a murder was part of this plan. Which begs the question, who benefited from the death of Martinez? I could be wrong, but it seems the likeliest that this was a hit job. And the payment for the hit job was $25,000, made by the victim himself. There is still the pesky business of that homicide file that appeared after 24 years. Remember, the J file is still missing, the juvenile file, but thankfully Sean doesn't need that anymore. I remember Marissa angrily talking about the homicide file numerous times, how frustrating it was that no one had it. Or, as it seems now, that no one wanted to turn it over.
I'm not really sure where it came from. What happened was, a few years ago, I went to the police department, and I asked if they would help me find evidence of Sean's arrest and detention in the 24 hours prior to the murder. And they said they would. To their great credit, they really looked, and they couldn't find anything. And the person who worked in the police commissioner's office told me that she was going to try to find the homicide file. And I said, what do you think you're going to find there that we don't already know? And she said, well, the homicide investigators apparently looked at Sean's alibi, so they might have something there that we don't have. And I thought, okay, great idea. So she couldn't find it. She went to the archive where it was supposedly held, and she was told that someone had signed it out and never returned it. So it was missing at the time. A year or so ago, when we first spoke to the DA's Conviction Review Unit, I asked them if they could help us find it. And they looked for it, and they couldn't find it right away. Probably maybe 3 or 4 months they were looking for it. I was looking for it for several years. I went to the archive. They had nothing on it. And I asked a few people in the police department. They couldn't find it. So finally, in May, I think it was May 12th, someone from the police department brought this box over to the DA's office, opened the door, and there it was. It was Sean Thomas. Well, it was actually Domingo Martinez homicide file. And the first thing, apparently, that the DA's found when they opened it up were these withheld documents on the stop of the three men in the gray Chevy Nova.
This wasn't all they found in the file, though. There was a note written by hand, notes taken during a conversation. The note was written in 1994, and the conversation was with Brian Cohen, the director of intake services at the Youth Study Center during the time that Sean appeared there in 1990. Cohen had, to refresh your memory, testified at trial. The note was written by Randolph Williams, the assistant DA and prosecutor in this case. It turned out the day before Cohen was called to testify, both the prosecutor and Sean's defense attorney went to meet with him. And Cohen had in his possession during that meeting Sean's J file. Randolph Williams got to look through it, and he made notes of what was in that file, including Sean's time of arrest from the night before Martinez was murdered to the time he was released, to a rough sketch of what the subpoena looked like, complete with a signature line. In other words, the prosecutor, the assistant district attorney, the very same man who examined a detective on the stand who said that he couldn't verify that Sean was at the Youth Study Center, the very same prosecutor who suggested to the jury that the person who showed up at the Youth Study Center was maybe somebody else and not Sean at all, that prosecutor had all but verified that it was Sean, that Sean was at the Youth Study Center that day. I think it merits mentioning that this prosecutor has been accused of misconduct in other cases, including a civil action filed against him in 1989, in which plaintiff John H. Davis alleges that the assistant district attorney conspired with the police to obtain a conviction against him through the use of coerced and perjured testimony during the trial. The court dismissed the claim, citing a number of cases that stand for the proposition that a prosecutor has, quote, absolute immunity for any actions taken within the scope of their duties in initiating and pursuing a criminal prosecution. The court goes on to say this, that this immunity has been held to apply even where a prosecutor allegedly falsified evidence and coerced perjury testimony for witnesses. Now, I have no idea if this plaintiff, John Davis, is guilty or innocent. I know nothing about the facts of his case. But what I do know is his allegations have a ring of familiarity about them. Because these allegations are similar to the ones other people who have been wrongfully convicted in Philadelphia and then exonerated have made, including people like Anthony Wright, who was exonerated through DNA evidence in Philadelphia a little over a year ago, after serving 25 years for a murder he didn't commit. Within a month of walking out of prison, he sued the city and the police department in Philadelphia for his wrongful conviction, alleging egregious conduct by 12 individual officers. In the complaint, Anthony Wright claims that police threatened his life to coerce him into signing a false confession, that the police falsely claimed that they found clothing connected to the crime in his own bedroom, and he says that one cop threatened to rip his eyes out and skull fuck him if he didn't confess. He also said, after hours of unsuccessful interrogation, the, quote, interrogating defendants handcuffed Mr. Wright to the chair and presented him with a 9-page handwritten statement. A statement that was a narrative of how the defendants thought the crime had occurred, the defendants meaning the cops in this case. All the details included by those defendants were there on that statement in order to fit the defendant's theory of the crime. And they demanded that Mr. Wright sign the statement. So who was the interrogating defendant? Who was the detective that wrote out that statement, the confession, that they tried to get Anthony Wright to sign? It was Detective Martin Devlin. I can't stop thinking about something Sean said to me when I met him, that he was lucky that he got arrested for trying to steal that bike. Now here was a man who had just spent 25 years behind bars for a crime he didn't commit, telling me he was lucky. Because if he had not gotten picked up for that theft, he never would have been at the Youth Study Center the next morning. He would have had no alibi when he got arrested 4 years later. And this haunts me. Because if we didn't have solid proof that Sean was at the Youth Study Center, well, what would you think? Are you sure you'd still believe he was innocent? Remember his brother Mustafa? Well, he's still in prison serving a life sentence for this same crime, even though everyone has recanted. He is still fighting through the appellate system, hoping that the new Brady evidence will give him another chance in court. But even if he gets another chance, he has to face this. Unlike Sean, he doesn't have an alibi. Now, one last thing that was found in that magically reappearing file. Information related to an entirely different murder. Not just any old information, though. Actual Brady material that was never turned over to the defense in that case either. And how do I know that? Because that case is our next case. Join us, and when I say us, I mean all three of us, Susan, Colin, and myself, when we return in 2 weeks with our next case about a wrongfully convicted man who is still in prison. The State versus Willie Veazey. Next time on Undisclosed. A big, big thank you to everybody who made this very important series possible. I have to begin by thanking the folks at the Pennsylvania Innocence Project, Marissa, Riley, Jim. You guys do amazing work, your entire teams. Thanks to you guys. Thank you to Sean Thomas and his family for allowing us to tell his story. Thank you to Mital Talhan as our executive producer. Thanks for keeping us going. Baluki, thank you so much for designing our logo. A big thanks to Patrick Cortez and Ramiro Marquez for our theme music. Thank you to all of our sponsors for making it possible for us to come back week after week. And also, thank you to John Cryer for agreeing to return to Undisclosed and hosting our addendum. You bring so much to the show. Thank you so very much. Audio production is done by Rebecca Lavoy of Partners in Crime Media, and she is the host of one of my favorite podcasts, by the way, Crime Writers On, and coming this week, a new podcast called AGTV and Me. Do not miss it. Definitely check it out. Don't forget to send any questions you have to us over Twitter and use the hashtag UDAddendum to tag those questions so John and Mital can collect them so we can respond to them in the addendum. And don't forget to follow us online on all our social media. Our handle is @UndisclosedPod. That's Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. Thanks so much for listening.